History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Harry Guggenheim was one of the richest people from the Gilded Age. He's most commonly known for the creation of the Solomon Guggenheim Museum, but he was also the co-founder of Newsday, but he had many other accomplishments that most people don't know about. He was a co-founder of Newsday, called the Godfather of Flight by Popular Science, chosen as the U.S. ambassador to Cuba, and a major thoroughbred racehorse owner. His business acumen and intellectual curiosity led to all sorts of interesting outcomes, including his friendship with Charles Lindbergh and the creation of a dynasty of ambitious family members. Today's guest is Dirk Smilley, and he's the author of The Business of Tomorrow, The Visionary Life of Harry Guggenheim, From Aviation and Rocketry to the Creation of an Art Dynasty. It shows that it was the singular force of Harry Guggenheim that guided his family's businesses into modernity. He was a combination of an angel investor, an entrepreneur, a technologist, and he launched businesses whose impact on the 20th century went far beyond his mines or museums. Most of all, he was a visionary that made speculative technology possible, arguably having a greater impact on the development of aviation than the Wright brothers. So this is somebody who's really only known for his museum today, but he had an incredible impact on the 20th century. So hope you enjoy this discussion with Dirk Smilley. Dirk, welcome to the show.
Scott, great to be with you.
Well, let's start with the entry point of if anyone had heard about Harry Guggenheim before. It's typically from the New York Art Museum, named after Solomon Guggenheim, which is his uncle, but he popularizes it. And most people, including myself, haven't really thought past that. And I just assume that he was a wealthy person from the Gilded Age. And he now has descendants who fund things that are worthy, but a little bit pretentious, like protecting the native habitats of endangered species. But what you say is that he's much more than that. So before getting into his contribution to avionics, his contribution to the early parts of the space age, where in your studies or your research did you first see Guggenheim as this person who's a node of all this activity that makes technology, science, entrepreneurship, and everything else possible?
Well, Scott, that's a great question. I wish I could say it was one place that I discovered that. I would say a kind of a turning point when it came to my looking for research on the family's contributions over the many decades, particularly in the areas that you describe, like avionics and then the space race. I came across a study that was done by the former dean of the Harvard Business School, and he and two colleagues basically looked at leadership in the air age, and they identified Harry as being in the mold of Jeff Bezos or sort of a foundational pioneer, a foundational entrepreneur. And they made the claim that Harry may have had a bigger impact on commercial aviation than the Wright brothers, which at first glance seemed to be utterly impossible to me. I mean, just for the obvious reasons, but they were making the case that once the airplane having been invented, the Wright brothers did an awful lot to try to protect their designs and their patents, and they went to court against a lot of people. And historians debate about the relative impact of that, but I think the Harvard team concluded that they had a large impact on slowing down commercial aviation. And Harry, on the other hand, came in and was kind of in current parlance, you might call him sort of an open hardware guy. You know, he was someone who wanted to disseminate technology, not protect it. And so his efforts to kind of roll out some of the foundational underpinnings of the commercial aviation business in its infancy, the Harvard team's kind of chronicling of that was a milestone in my research. It's sort of an objective account of what I suspected Harry's role was, but it was good to see people who had actually spent much more time than I ever had or could have studying leadership in the air age. That was that was kind of a seminal study that I used in my research. And the rest of it, in terms of quantitative research coming out of academe or business research, a lot of it was journalism from that age and looking at the reporting of the Guggenheim family investments and their philanthropy, what I call sort of tactical philanthropy, and what today I guess is known as social impact investing. That's kind of the coverage that I paid the most attention to, because that was the lens that I was looking through at Harry, you know, him as a as an investor and a philanthropist.
Before getting in too far to his accomplishments, it's good to look at his background. And figures who come out during this time period in the early 20th century, or going back to the late 19th century, when you think of the industrial titans, or some call them robber barons, many come from very hardscrabble upbringings, like John Rockefeller. His father was a bigamist. He worked as a bookkeeper for a while before he began to build his oil empire. Carnegie, I think, was also a completely broke Scottish immigrant. Guggenheim has a little bit more means. He obviously builds up his fortune, but what's Guggenheim's background?
Well, Harry is the second of three kids. They were all born close to the turn of the century. Harry was a third generation Guggenheim, and it was his grandfather and his father who really made the family fortune. And when you talk about the robber barons of that age, you know, they would, I guess, loosely fit into that category in the sense of the mining business, because that's really how they made their money, initially in mining and then in smelting. And then there was one pivotal moment when Harry's father, Daniel, fended off a takeover attempt of the family business by a much larger conglomerate of companies. Asarco was the name of it. And so Daniel kind of engineered this counter move where the Guggenheims essentially bought majority stakes in Asarco companies and wound up taking over the company that was trying to take over them. And I think at that point, you know, they became the largest mining conglomerate on earth. And right through up until the Depression, the amount of money that they were making in that business was really staggering. And I don't think that what we know Harry for, all of his philanthropy and his business investing, that really didn't start to happen until the mid-1920s and then right through the Depression. And I think the family at that point started to become known more for spending its fortune rather than making it.
Well, I'm curious, the point you made earlier that he arguably had a greater impact on the development of aviation than the Wright brothers. Where does his interest in aviation come from? And what does he do that has such a huge impact on it, on the development of flight?
Well, he first got exposed to aviation when he trained to be a seaplane pilot during World War I. And I think he had the idea that by enlisting, he might, you know, sort of be involved in all of these aerial dogfights was being reported practically on a daily basis during the war. You know, air combat was sort of seen as this really kind of daring, kind of cutting edge, adventurous thing. And, you know, people were not reporting as much the fact that your lifespan as a pilot and during World War I was probably going to be very short. So Harry went in as a more of a technician and as a kind of an administrative person, someone who would go and do quality control over at seaplane stations set up by the U.S. and by France in particular during the war. And he first got exposed to aviation in that period. And then when he came back, his father was getting more and more interested in his kind of his philanthropic legacy and kind of figuring out where to put his money in coming years. And Harry was such an advocate of aviation. I think he could see that, you know, it had a real potential for being a major transportation network in the same way as, you know, trains were. And so Harry kind of convinced his father that it would be a really worthy area of philanthropy for them, particularly after the success of their first grant, which was to NYU for an aeronautical training school at New York University. That was a huge success for them, at least as far as public opinion went and press coverage. And I think they realized that that could be a template for a larger national initiative. So with his father's money, Harry went on to found all these aviation engineering schools around the country. And then he did all these other things that he perceived the private sector was not willing to do at that time. For example, at Caltech, put a lot of money into a building a wind tunnel. And that was with the idea that a lot of small-time kind of mom-and-pop aviation companies that were just getting started, you know, they didn't really have enough money to build their own wind tunnel. But people like William Boeing and the folks from Lockheed, they could come and test their, you know, wing designs at this wind tunnel at Caltech, which is in Pasadena, California. So lots of different sort of one-off initiatives like that. And some of the more significant ones in the later years involved the full flight laboratory at Mitchell Field, which basically led to the first blind flight in history. That was when Jimmy Doolittle, who was a pilot for Harry, went up in a plane and basically took off and landed completely based on instrumentation and not by any kind of visual associations, as every pilot was, you know, doing at the time. So there was that. Then there was a program that Harry paid for, which involved Charles Lindbergh going to 48 states. I think he landed in 82 cities. He called that the reliability tour. And that was that was kind of set up with the idea of presenting aviation as a safer thing than what most people considered of the day. And, you know, as you know, most people hadn't even seen an airplane up close and personally in that time being, you know, the mid to late 1920s. So Lindbergh landing precisely at 2 p.m. every day and then taking off the next day, you know, people could sort of see with their own eyes the, you know, the reliability and the safety of flying. So that was another initiative by Harry's fund. And, you know, some people criticize it at the time as being a kind of a shotgun approach. But I would say, you know, all these initiatives in varying degrees represented sort of financial spark plugs that were designed to help provide R&D and advanced technology that the private sector, as it existed at the time in aviation, was not really doing.
I read a biography on Wilbur and Orville Wright, one by David McCullough, and I've had guests on the show come and talk about them. One part of their story that I didn't know about is that they resisted the spread of aviation. I mean, not intentionally, of course, but they are aggressively protecting their own patents. They want due financial recompense for what they've done, but that is a limiting factor in how it can grow. But Guggenheim is able to get over this. So I'm curious, how does he do this? And how he spread it, you cite that this has been studied by the Harvard Business School, and they compare him to with Steve Jobs or Jeff Bezos and others. So what's happening in the early aviation? How does he break this logjam? And what is this comparable from the modern period in the 21st century to people doing similar things in their industry?
Boy, that's a really great question. You know, at some point, I think the Wright brothers started to see the writing on the wall, and that there it was sort of like, you know, putting toothpaste back in the tube. I mean, there were so many different people, both in the United States and in Europe, who were experimenting with new types of airplanes and new types of sort of aviation design, wing design. So I think at a certain point, they eventually joined up with Glenn Curtiss, who was another pioneer aviator, to manufacture engines. And then, of course, as you know, one of the brothers died. That left one. And I think they were sort of exhausted trying to protect their patents when, you know, aviation was clearly becoming like the business of the future. So when that bridge was crossed, I'm not exactly sure. But I think with every, you know, Harry was also bringing in Orville Wright to a lot of these fund initiatives. And, you know, he put Orville Wright in charge of the Safe Plane competition that he conducted. And Orville Wright was a strong partner to all of Harry's aviation efforts in the early days. But to bring it up to present day, you know, I would say, and maybe this is kind of an obvious answer, but Elon Musk, to me, is doing things in terms of space research and space investing very much differently than Branson or Jeff Bezos. I mean, I sort of see them as more advancing the world of space tourism, whereas, you know, Musk founded SpaceX, what, 20 years ago? He got funding from Fidelity and Google for the satellite internet service that he's testing now. And, you know, he's not a philanthropist in the traditional sense, but as an entrepreneur, I think he's kind of moving in directions that remind me of Harry in some respects. I mean, you know, one comparison might be with Elon Musk testing out the internet service. I mean, he's rolling it out to what I think is largely early adopters, and a lot of those folks are business folks, you know, people who have the deep pockets and the wealth who can afford to, you know, be part of this. And I think early on in aviation, Harry saw business practitioners and, you know, people who saw the value in, let's say, the idea of taking a plane from LA to San Francisco, which could get you up there in a couple of hours, maybe 3 hours at that time, you know, versus spending the entire day on a train. You know, that probably seemed like a really good idea to certain people who, you know, saw the value of meetings and sort of time management and all of that. So I think in that respect, you know, I think both Harry and Elon Musk have been very savvy about identifying early adopters in their respective businesses. And I think, you know, certainly paid off in Harry's case. And I suspect that SpaceX will someday go public. And if you think Elon Musk is rich now, the sky's the limit, to use a bad pun. But in any case, I think Elon Musk is the closest among the three sort of more better known space investors currently that kind of match up to what Harry was doing.
Yeah, there's other partnerships like this that Harry Guggenheim reminds me of. One is a relationship between Walt Disney and the original Walt Disney, the man himself, and Wernher von Braun. So there's the public facing person, the person with funds, the popularizer of ideas, and then the actual scientist. You don't always have to have those two, but you do see this dynamic. And this is an example.
Yeah, very interesting.
Well, I mean, one with Robert Goddard, I'm interested to hear about this because, I mean, it's one thing to be a visionary and see the potential of aviation, but that's quite clear out the 1920s after World War I. But visualize rocketry and to fund that in the 1920s and 1930s. This is decades before the V2 rocket program of Nazi Germany, several decades before the Apollo program. And just, I mean, at this time, there's only the theoretical basis that's being set up with Konstantin Tsiolkovsky and Robert Goddard, too. So can you tell me about why and how Guggenheim gets involved in rocketry?
Yeah, I mean, that's just a really interesting point, because I think that's absolutely true, Scott. You could see the future of aviation in a myriad ways, which isn't to say that people in the early days who believed in it weren't visionary, but to see the future of rocketry, particularly at a time when the military seemed to have very limited, if any, interest in it, you know, which is the kind of logical sector that you might imagine could be a potential underwriter of it at some point. But I think that Harry, you know, he was very close to Lindbergh in those days, right around the same period we're talking about, late 20s, early 30s, and he respected Lindbergh's judgment. And when Lindbergh spent time with Goddard, I think he influenced Harry's kind of vision of Goddard. I mean, Goddard came to their attention in this very kind of backhanded way. It was this moment when Harry was being considered for ambassador to Cuba. And this was, I think, around the summer of 1929. And Harry and Lindbergh and Harry's wife, Carol, were sitting around the living room at Harry's home, Falaise, out on the North Fork of Long Island. And Carol read aloud some story about Goddard's latest experiment, where he was basically testing rockets out of his aunt's cabbage patch up in Massachusetts. And, you know, the story intrigued Harry. He said to Lindbergh, why don't you go check this guy out? Because, you know, we've been talking about what's the next era of aviation after aviation? What is the upward extension of aviation going to be? And they were talking about this constantly, and rocketry was something they talked about a lot. So in any case, Lindbergh checked Goddard out and became convinced that he was probably the best bet that they had if they were going to put money into a single scientist, which at that time was pretty rare. You know, if you're going to invest in or put your philanthropic money into something, you probably would want to do it with an institution or you know, some kind of an entity that involves more than one lone practitioner of rocket test out in his aunt's farm in Massachusetts. So anyway, I think when Harry started to see the unbelievable, I mean, you know, one thing that Goddard was able to do was he was a physicist, but he brought together many bodies of knowledge to design his rockets. When we're talking about liquid propulsion, you know, it's a complicated thing to get a projectile thousands of feet up in the air to stay straight and to stop itself from blowing up, you know, right after it launches. There's so much science that goes into that and so much trial and error. So Harry would get these reports back from Goddard, these long detailed letters talking about, you know, new designs to the propulsion system or new elements within his gyroscopic stabilizer that he was developing. I think Harry could see that Goddard was really a good bet, even though the Smithsonian and the Carnegie Institution had both invested early in Goddard, but then basically kind of peeled away from him. So if you add up all the years that Harry backed Goddard, I think it's close to a decade where he basically provided him funding, you know, almost consistently back to back in all of those years, right up until the 40s, till the start of the war. So it's interesting. I mean, the Guggenheims have a trait in the family where they've always been very talented, sort of talent scouts. You know, they, starting with John Hayes Hammond back in the late 19th century, this guy who was like the Indiana Jones of prospecting, he would find mine after mine for the Guggenheims to invest in. And, you know, they were good at finding people who could perceive things differently than others. And I think that both Lindbergh and Harry saw that in Robert Goddard, and they stuck with him, you know, all the way to the end.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. And I definitely want to get into that, his approach to business and use of alternate metrics. But one other thing with Guggenheim's funding of Robert Goddard and the Proto Jet Propulsion Laboratory, what did he hope to achieve? Did he have any wild-eye optimistic, you know, World's Fair, City of Tomorrow type of visions for what this could happen? Or did he just realize that, well, this is a future, so we should just establish a good foundation now so we can be ahead when maybe, I don't want to say predicting the Cold War, but realizing that there's going to be some element of this that will be significant, so we might as well get ahead of the start.
Yeah, I wish Harry had been that visionary. I think he saw early rockets as just a more efficient way to deliver mail, as crazy as that sounds. But he literally talked about that in public speeches, the potential for that anyway. I think he was aware that rockets could possibly be kind of fused with aviation, and particularly in a military context where, you know, a couple of short-term rockets could increase the lift and certainly the payload of any plane taking off from a carrier at sea. That became pretty obvious as they got closer and closer to the war. But, you know, in the case of the Jet Propulsion Lab, you know, that was a program that was an outgrowth of Theodore von Karman's work. As you know, Harry paid for von Karman to come over from Germany in the 30s and to start to do research for the Guggenheim Lab at Caltech. And so that group of young rocket pioneers, I guess they're known as the Suicide Squad, they sort of, you know, their work kind of led to the Jet Propulsion Lab. And I think if Harry had lived long enough to see all of the work that JPL has done over the years, I think he would have thought that was, you know, that was money well spent. But that was Harry's approach, you know, he giving money to an institution like Caltech, and then also kind of hedging his bets by funding Goddard directly. And I think, you know, Harry, you know, he was very cautious about what he said around Goddard's work, because, you know, Goddard had been basically the subject of, you know, hundreds of articles ridiculing his work year after year. And it was very interesting to me when I was doing this research to find that when the Guggenheim funding first went in for Robert Goddard, 1929, 1930, the stories about Goddard being this wacky scientist trying to hit the moon, those more or less disappeared. So there was like a tremendous kind of legitimacy or credibility that the Guggenheim funding gave Goddard. So that was kind of a turning point in terms of Goddard's public image. But I think that Harry, at least in the early years, really just wanted Goddard to hit elevations that would be high enough to impress the U.S. military, the Navy in particular. Air Force hadn't been created yet. You know, aviation was kind of a stepchild of the military at that point, a sort of split between the Army and the Navy. And Harry saw great applicability with rocketry within the military infrastructure, but the military really was not all that interested in Goddard until he started to hit these higher elevations, and also when they started to see the potential for rocket-propelled, or what became known as jet-propelled takeoffs. So I think Harry kind of, if he had any dreams about interplanetary travel, I'm sure that he did, but he really didn't make that known very much, if at all, because I think he was concerned about bringing back the old ideas about space travel as being completely sort of the kind of thing that Jules Verne aficionados dream about, but, you know, not real life people like you and me.
That's interesting that this development is happening on what would later become intercontinental ballistic missiles, when at the time, naval warfare is still centered around battleships and aircraft carriers haven't even taken their position as the most important piece of the naval chessboard, which doesn't really happen until World War II. So it's funny to imagine the speculation in the future, but then much more older approaches to things. And we've only touched on a couple of his industries that he was involved in with aviation, rocketry, but he was also a publisher, a thoroughbred horse racer, not racing himself, but involved in it, and built up the Guggenheim Museum. And you mentioned that he used alternate business metrics for strategy. I mean, it sounds like a modern day approach to business, which is aggressively data driven. When you have a content management system that gives you a universe of data and spreadsheets, and consulting firms can be worth billions of dollars to use data approaches to improve a business. This isn't really how businesses operate at all at this time in history. So what is his approach to business and the metrics that he uses to try to arrive at success?
You know, given the breadth of the businesses that he was involved in, it's kind of hard to answer that in a singular way. You know, I think like in the horse racing business that you mentioned, you know, Harry literally started with one horse in the early 30s. And in about 20 years, he built it into the, you know, it became the highest earning stables in the U.S. I went to the Kentucky Derby 5 times. And so he set up a set of metrics to look at potential winners on the track, but not so much focusing on the intricacies of the bloodlines, which was, you know, sort of the conventional wisdom of the day, but looking at things like pregnancy rates that his mares had, or looking at the gaits of his horses compared with the intervals of their breathing. And he would like do these charts that would, you know, using his own metrics, so to speak, to try to predict, you know, which horses were really worth cultivating. So he had, you know, he would use one set of metrics for something like that. You know, I think in the case of these other businesses, I mean, you mentioned the museum and Newsday, the newspaper that he co-founded with his wife, Alicia Patterson. In the case of the newspaper, I think he was playing a mostly behind the scenes role as a business manager, negotiating with the unions at the time. Particularly during World War II, it was very difficult to get newsprint at a good price on a regular basis. So he did a lot of that sort of behind the scenes. I would say in terms of alternative metrics, he also came up with a kind of an interesting set of approaches when he was chairman of the Crime Commission in New York City, because people were trying to figure out why there was so much corruption in these various DA offices. So basically, make a long story short, Harry sat down with a team and created punch cards for every single crime that occurred in every county of New York for the prior year. And instead of looking at the crimes themselves or what may have caused them, he looked at the conviction rates and who was able to post bail and who wasn't, what case, in what situations were juries potentially being tampered with and weren't. So, you know, he basically took this moneyball approach, looking at every crime statistic in New York City. And, you know, ultimately this led to a number of people being, well, in one case, a district attorney in Brooklyn was sent to Sing Sing for corruption. But that was not a business that he was running per se, but he was applying some of his own business principles to a kind of a independent sector commission that was set up at the time. So, you know, I'd say in each one of these businesses, the answer is probably a little bit different in terms of what kind of metrics he set up to assess business performance. But in most cases, I would say he did pretty well. And that's really the reason that I was interested in his story in the first place. You know, having been a reporter at Forbes for a decade, I really can't say I ever came across anybody in business who had this sort of this diversity of both businesses that he created and kind of these philanthropic initiatives that in some cases resembled more social impact spending than actual philanthropy.
Not that there's a grand unified theory of business, despite what MLMs or other things like that will try to convince you of, but it does sound like if there is a cross-domain, cross-industry approach to doing things, he seems to have come as close as somebody reasonably could have come to for success in such different industries.
It's interesting too, Scott, that I was just going to mention, you know, there's a story in the New York Times today about, you know, what business school students are interested in. And I don't think I was really even aware of this, but classes on social impact investing are wildly popular at business schools today. And I think Stanford reported last year that something like 1 out of 5 of its MBAs are going to companies that have a strong focus on social impact investing, or they've expressed interest in finding work in with those kind of companies, or what I guess we're calling today ESG, a little bit different than social impact investing, but it's an area that has a lot of growth and a lot of interest with the next generation.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Right. I mean, it sounds very contemporary. And the other thing too, the most famous namesake, the Guggenheim Museum, previously it had a very interesting name, the Museum of Non-Objective Art, wondering what that means, since we think today of ridiculous abstract art, but that's not what they're going for, obviously. So when he rebrands it, what else does he do when he brings the way that he brought innovation to other sectors? What does he do that I think really lays the foundation of how the American public today associates with art? And it seems like the Guggenheim had a huge influence on that. So what did he do to build it up and, you know, brand it?
I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, I don't think Harry really had any particular interest in modern art before he joined the museum board. He joined the board because his uncle Solomon, who was in the process of building the museum, wanted Harry to join, you know, just as a family member. And so 2 years later, Solomon passes away, and the person who was running the museum board at the time was running it from England. And the problem with that was that at that particular moment in the Guggenheim's evolution, it was known as the Museum of Non-Objective Art. And it was kind of a smaller museum that was run by Hilla Rebe, who was Harry's uncle Solomon's muse and his art director. And non-objective art is a kind of a niche, a sort of a subset of abstract art or modern art. And it's represented by people like, Kandinsky. There's a huge Kandinsky exhibit that just opened at the Guggenheim recently. And so it's a very legitimate, you know, from the eyes of the art world and curators. It's an interesting niche, but it's just that, a niche. And Solomon's collection at that time, this being late 40s, early 1950s, was a collection of many different types of modern artists. You had Chagall's, you had Picasso's, but all this other stuff was basically collecting dust in the storage archives, whereas Hilla Rebe, the director at the time, was promoting non-objective art as being like the art of the future. She was making all kinds of crazy claims, like saying that, you know, someone who was a convicted murderer who would sit down in a room with some non-objective art suddenly would have a psychological effect on him and probably cause him to never commit a crime again. You know, claims like this. And in any case, the art scene at the time, the art establishment, which included a art critic at the New York Times, was really kind of losing patience with not only this kind of very narrow niche of art that Hilla Rebe was showing at the precursor to the Guggenheim Museum, but also just a lot of complaints had been arisen about the management of the museum. Hilla Rebe was playing favorites with certain artists that she liked. She even threw her own art exhibition that had nothing but Hilla Rebe's art in it, you know, over 300 pieces. And so anyway, the New York Times at one point said, you know, the Guggenheims don't seem to be able to manage their own art collection or their own art museum up to the obligations of what a nonprofit organization should meet. Why don't they just turn over their art to a real art institution like the Whitney or the Met or MoMA, and, you know, they'll know what to do. So, you know, obviously that was a colossal insult to the family. Harry knew he had to do something. So just in brief, in addition to changing the name of the museum, which, in, you know, reflected the fact that it was going to be a much broader approach, and also the fact that it would be kind of branding Frank Lloyd Wright's masterpiece with the family brand. And so there's some implications for that as well. But in any case, I think Harry's reforms, in addition to getting rid of Hilla Rebe, changing the name of the museum, and then broadening its mandate, he also instituted some administrative reforms that kind of professionalized the museum to some degree. And that's kind of in a nutshell some of the things that Harry did to kind of get the museum back on a good footing. And I think it has served the museum well for all these years and years to come.
There are many strands of his life to explore, but I think to tie them all together, we could talk about his legacy, which we've mentioned some of the ways that he's had profound influence on different sectors. Today, even though it's not just something for history, he has a management firm that has something like $300 billion assets under management. So that's one thing can you discuss, but then also more broadly speaking, how would you describe his legacy?
That's true, Scott, what you say about the management firm. I don't think he necessarily even ever envisioned that the Guggenheim brand would be used to create a sort of a full-service financial services firm like Guggenheim Partners. But, you know, we were just talking about the reforms that Harry put into effect. I think that that created a certain level of credibility, even trust in the Guggenheim as an institution. And those are the kinds of qualities you would certainly want with people who you are going to allow to manage and invest your money. So in that sense, there was a very strong alignment between what the museum represented and the company that was created on Wall Street with the Guggenheim name. So that's why I kind of consider it to be a legacy of Harry's. And, you know, in terms of his larger legacy, I think that Harry embraced a kind of an ethos that you don't hear or read about as much today as I think we should, which is a sense of really a strong responsibility to use inherited wealth to create institutions that last and, you know, that have social impact. So I think that's his larger legacy. You know, he was certainly a technology disruptor and a cultural disruptor in some ways, but I think his lasting legacy is a really good example or even a blueprint for how people like, if I can be so presumptuous as to say Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk, you know, how to spend inherited wealth in a responsible way.
That's very good. I mean, I'm glad that we do still have a sense of noblesse oblige. And yeah, people are always going to buy their super yachts, but when that was almost the exclusive purview of how wealthy people spent things, it's nice that others are thinking a little bit more broadly. Well, this is a really fascinating person to look at, and there's a lot more in his story. And for listeners who want to check that out, the name of Dirk's book is The Business of Tomorrow, The Visionary Life of Harry Guggenheim from Aviation and Rocketry, The Creation of an Art Dynasty. Dirk, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
All right, that is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.